from our revolving radio studios high atop our Zeppelin mooring tower, your North Carolina Reading Service brings the following to our blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week from September the 22nd of 2021, and it's read by John Federson. Since we have to physically climb up 9 flights of stairs to reach high above the downtown skyscrapers, we were unable to get any musicians to play our theme today, so we're just dropping the needle on our 78.8 RPM Victrola. And as I cleverly fade them down, we're ready to begin this week's issue. And as usual, we have a mix of print articles from the issue printed Wednesday, and then more recent editions on the Indie Week website that I'll just shift back and forth. First, from Tomasi McDonald in Durham, shorthanded. Last month, Durham City Council member Deidrana Freeman called 911 to report that a 17-year-old boy had been shot in the parking lot of a convenience store at East Main and South Elm Streets. Freeman, who lives in the community, heard gunshots while inside her home. Her husband went outside to see what was going on after they heard a woman screaming. 4 minutes passed before an emergency dispatcher answered her call. Freeman told the Indy that the 911 line rang repeatedly while she watched the teen's life energy bleed out onto the asphalt. "I called at least twice," Freeman said. "My husband and neighbor tried to get through as well." Another neighbor, Costa Gramatis, posted on social media that women were howling, men were pacing on their phones trying to get through to 9/11. A boy, red shirt, closed eyes, lay motionless on the boiling sidewalk, blood pooling around him. Gramatis wrote, "It took 15 rings before the 9/11 dispatcher picked up my call. Police on the way. We waited. The police station is a block away. But we waited. And as they pulled up, a man started screaming and stomped right up to him. Where the F have you been? Where the F have you been?" Freeman later learned the teen died from his injuries at the hospital. Durham Emergency Communications Center Director Randy Beeman says the DECC is reviewing the call and officer response time. Never mind minutes. Seconds can make a world of difference during tragedies like the one Freeman and her neighbors witnessed on August 11th, just after 6:30 p.m. And the Bull City is enduring a 911 staffing shortage. Emergency officials say the city needs call takers, dispatchers, and supervisors quick, fast, and in a hurry to answer the phones and alert first responders. Things have gotten so bad that the 911 center this year started routing emergency calls to Raleigh's Emergency Communications Center. The mutual aid ended this summer when Durham's emergency call volume was at its highest. Officials have assembled short-term and long-term initiatives to bring in more workers, including online notices, social media postings, and job fairs. Last week, DECC officials hosted a job fair where 32 attendees applied for jobs. Earlier this month, 25 applied for jobs with 911 Center. The DECC is also working hard to retain its current employees with bonus incentives, double time pay, salary increases, and shifts that allow for a holistic work-life balance. Durham's Public Affairs Director, Beverly Thompson, confirmed in an email that the Bull City's Emergency Communications Center, not unlike many 9/11 centers across the country, is facing a staffing shortage. Thompson says Durham has, quote, experienced elevated vacancies for a number of years. Last week, as of late Friday afternoon, only 50 of the center's 83 full-time positions have been filled. More pointedly, just 30 of the 60 frontline positions for call takers, dispatchers, and shift supervisors were occupied, according to statistics. Thompson points to the pandemic as a critical factor in the shortages experienced over the past year, adding, "The shortages were felt acutely when staff called out due to illness or were quarantined due to exposure. Our high vacancy rate does have an impact on the workload for remaining staff, and we acknowledge it has resulted in some extended wait times." Earlier this month, Beeman pointed to another reason to explain the center's high vacancy rate. The agency can't seem to retain its employees. Thompson said the 9/11 Center remains, quote, fully functional despite the challenges and wants to remind callers to stay on the line if they dial 911. Don't hang up, she added. But City Council member Mark Anthony Middleton said during a September 9 City Council work session that he's, quote, not comfortable with the city in a somewhat spectator posture, watching and hoping for a better outcome in the midst of an ongoing 911 crisis. Middleton called for an all-hands-on-deck approach, including, again, routing emergency calls to another municipality. The impact of the staffing vacancies reached a dismal apex in July, when 9/11 dispatchers fielded its highest number of calls for the year, almost 28,000, according to the call data. Beeman, during the work session, told City Council member that July's call total was the most the center had received over a one-month period in 5 years. Deputy Durham City Manager Bo Ferguson told council members, quote, the August data will look a lot like the July data. Thompson said, as of July, the average call answer time is just over 10 seconds for someone dialing 911 in Durham. Beeman stated the obvious during his presentation at the City Council work session. A fully functioning 911 center is critically important, saying, quote, I recognize and take responsibility that we are not meeting acceptable standards of call answer times. We are not meeting the expectations of our residents or visitors when callers are not able to receive assistance at an appropriate time for emergencies. Thompson said the 911 center is, quote, continually evaluating the optimal staffing needed during various times to meet the industry standard, which is 90% of all 911 calls answered in 10 seconds or less. Working at the center is not a bad gig. It pays better than so-called essential worker positions like McDonald's, Walmart, or Freddy's, whose employees in Durham and across the country have been clamoring for a living wage of at least $15 an hour and a union. The starting salary at the 911 center for entry-level call taker is $38,100 a year, with benefits. Beeman said the 911 center is shoring up the staffing shortage by asking administrative staffers and call takers to be available when needed. The center is receiving help from 911 staffers with the fire department, sheriff's office, emergency medical services, and Duke University. Some former and retired employees who are working part-time, on average about 20 hours a week, are also assisting the center. Middleton asked Beeman if the city is better off now than when, quote, Raleigh left us in a lurch. What's different? Beeman replied that Durham is in the same place, quote, or better than we were. We're better than we were. Middleton was not convinced, and again stressed that the city should seek out another municipality for mutual aid until the Bull City Center is fully staffed. Quote, we need to look for another partner to help us. There's no shame in that. Durham sends out help to its partners all the time. Moving right along, Jasmine Gallup from Indie Week. News from Wake County, the last straw. The pandemic, coupled with the legislature's long-standing lack of support for public school teachers, means many Wake educators and school staff are leaving the profession. Former Wake County teacher Becca Brown loved her job, and she was good at it. But after 5 years of her career going nowhere and 18 months of working weekends during a global pandemic, she made the tough decision to quit in June. She told the Indy, it was really a bittersweet feeling when I finally decided, okay, I'm not doing this anymore. Part of the culture of being a teacher is it attracts people who want to help, who are willing to sacrifice themselves to help their students, to help fellow teachers. It feels like you're letting people down, especially in the middle of a pandemic, when I know I'm not the only one putting in 20-plus extra hours a week. Brown wasn't the only teacher who burned out this year. At the end of the 2021 school year, about 12.5% of employees in the school district, teachers and support staff, opted to leave. That's a slight increase over the 1920 school year when about 11.3% resigned or retired. The attrition rate last year was about on par with the rate before the pandemic, when about 12.8% of teachers and staff chose to leave for 18 and 19. But the reasons teachers have for leaving have changed. The challenges of the coronavirus pandemic, combined with a decade of cuts to public school funding, have driven many teachers to resign or retire early, says Kristen Beller, president of the Wake County branch of the NC Association of Educators. The pandemic alone would have been an overwhelming challenge to teachers and staff, but systemic defunding of public schools made it a true crisis, Beller told Indy. In the past decade, we lost 8,000 instructional assistant positions. We lost over 5,000 teacher positions that were cut from the state budget. We lost close to $70 million in textbook funding one year. We lost master's pay. We lost longevity pay. And those are things that help retain people. The pandemic is sort of like the straw that broke the camel's back. That was certainly the case for Brown, who says she felt an enormous feeling of relief after resigning. Even after her first year of teaching, quote, the anxiety of having to go to school on Monday never went away. Brown was having panic attacks almost every Sunday night. Quote, when I resigned, all of a sudden it was Sunday, and it was like I can breathe. I knew early on from my mental health it was not going to be sustainable. When the pandemic hit, it became very obvious. I had my children at home downstairs doing virtual learning, and because I'm trying to show up as my best teacher self, I'm not showing up for my family. The pandemic may have pushed Brown forward, but her decision was a long time coming, she says. One factor was her fixed salary. Brown's first year as a teacher was also her husband's first year in an entry-level job at a financial company, she says. Quote, after 5 years, he was making twice as much as I would make if I stayed in education for 25 years. As a fresh coming out of college kid, my salary did seem like a lot of money, but then you realize very quickly, this is it. It doesn't get much better than this. Another former educator, Regina Fecht, F-E-U-C-H-T, was forced to retire early this year so she could look after her grandchildren at home. Fecht, in her mid-60s, was a teacher's assistant at Abbots Creek Elementary before she gave up her work to help her daughter and son-in-law with childcare. Fecht doesn't want to stop working, but when her grandchildren's daycare service temporarily closed, her daughter needed help, she says. Even now with the kids back in school, Fecht's daughter often needs someone on hand to pick up the kids if their classroom is quarantined or drive them to a COVID test. Fecht says, the pandemic drove the whole decision for me. I probably would have worked 2 or 3 more years. I hadn't contemplated retiring. I miss the work. I miss the people. I miss a lot of it. At the start of the traditional school year, Wake County had 366 vacancies among nearly 12,000 teaching positions. That's a vacancy rate of about 3%, according to Sarah Clark, a spokeswoman for the district. That's triple the number of vacancies in 2019 and 2020, when the county only had about 100 vacancies amongst the 11,000 positions at the start of the school year. Part of the increase is due to the addition of new positions this year, Clark wrote in an email. Those include new openings for teachers in the district's virtual academy and for long-term substitute teachers at each school building. The district has since filled some of those positions, bringing the overall vacancy rate down to 2.6%, and the rate among virtual academy teachers down to 4.5% from 18.5%. Still, the number of open positions is creating an unsustainable amount of work. With an ongoing shortage of substitute teachers, class sizes may be bigger, Beller says. Some administrators or instructional assistants are being asked to act as substitute teachers, while other educators are asked to cover classes during their planning periods. Beller says, educators are regularly pulling 10 to 11-hour days, adding they spend about 7 hours a day with the students and another 3 or 4 planning lessons, talking to parents, or coordinating with principals. Quote, but in a situation like this, when they don't have any planning period during the middle of the day, they're exerting more energy. Burnout is going to happen at a much higher rate. Instructional assistants are also spread thin, according to Beller. Instead of being assigned to one or two classes, they're being assigned to three or four, cutting back the amount of time they can spend in the classroom. Instead of helping students, they end up doing clerical work or taking on additional lunch duty. Likewise, office and support staff are asked to cover double their usual amount of work. In most schools, there are only one or two custodians who work during the day, while a contract service comes in at night to clean. Bus drivers are doing multiple runs to and from school, starting work earlier and ending later. Earlier this month, one bus driver turned down a bottle of cold water because they didn't have enough time to stop for a bathroom break, says Beller. They said, quote, I have four runs. If I stop at a school, go to the bathroom, that means I'm going to be late dropping off my kids. So in addition to the impact it has on the students, being able to get to school on time or home at a reasonable time and parents to plan childcare, it also has a really negative effect on the actual people who are caring for our students. Before the pandemic, teachers and staff were able to patchwork solve problems that arose because of lack of resources, according to Beller. But when the coronavirus hit, staff and funding shortages severely curtailed the ability of schools to respond. She closes by saying, in a time like this, we're really going to have to prioritize. In a crisis moment when we have a pandemic happening, a shortage of staff, no hope coming from the General Assembly, in a moment like that, we really just can't keep doing things the way we've always done them. Next, from Lee Taus in Raleigh. This article is connected to a debate which is taking place at Chavis Community Center. I believe it's tonight at 6 p.m. Capital cases, marijuana misdemeanors, and police brutality are on the docket in the Democratic primary for Wake County District Attorney. Residents won't cast ballots in Wake County's municipal race until next fall, but who they back in the March primary for District Attorney could reshape the criminal justice system's approach to everything from high-profile murder trials to low-level marijuana crimes. District attorneys don't write the law, but they enjoy immense power in interpreting it. They decide whether to press charges against police officers who shoot citizens or whether to pursue a case as a capital crime. In the March 2022 primary, both major candidates are Democrats. They couldn't be more different. For the last 7 years, District Attorney Lauren Freeman has taken a measured approach to prosecuting in the increasingly liberal county. Her philosophy, she says, is that it's her job to enforce the law, not allow personal political beliefs to guide policy. While the number of capital cases has decreased over the last decade, Freeman says the death penalty is still warranted for the most egregious of crimes, and she's pursued it in several high-profile cases. She told the Indy during a recent phone interview, at the end of the day, the legislature is the one who makes the determination as to whether capital punishment remains on the books or not. While I certainly have discretion in those cases in which I seek it, I personally believe that I'm sworn to uphold the law. To come out and say I would never seek it, I don't believe is appropriate. Freeman's challenger, Damon Chetson, disagrees. If elected, he vows to use his discretion to effectively end the death penalty in Wake County and stop prosecuting certain nonviolent misdemeanors such as marijuana possession. Quote, the Democratic voters in this county are progressive, and yet we have a prosecutor who in some ways is far more regressive than Republican prosecutors in other counties, particularly on the death penalty. Freeman and Chetson will face off at a forum hosted by Emancipate NC this week, fielding questions on criminal justice reform and racial equality. The debate will be moderated by Dawn Blagrove, executive director of Emancipate NC, who says the county's DA, quote, is the most powerful actor in the criminal justice system and that the candidates must be fully vetted by the community so an informed voting decision can be made. This office has the power to radically transform the experienced, marginalized people have when justice is involved. As public servants, DAs should be guided not by upholding racist traditions and systems rooted in creating inequitable results, but instead by policies that recognize the deep biases baked into the system, and using the power of the office to undo past harms and create a more just system moving forward. For Chetson, that starts with ending the death penalty. In 2013, the Racial Justice Act, which said race could not be a factor in seeking the death penalty, was repealed. Courts, however, have since ruled it retroactively available for the 145 inmates on death row at the time. Sentences in those cases are now eligible to be reheard in court. The outcome could effectively end capital punishment in the state, experts say. If the first few cases uphold the statistical evidence showing widespread racial bias in jury selection on the part of state prosecutors, the evidence will be binding for subsequent cases in that district. North Carolina hasn't executed anyone since 2006. There are now only 136 people on death row. State prosecutors just aren't pursuing capital cases as often. In 2019, Wake County sentenced Siaga Gillard to death for the murder of two people in a Raleigh motel, the district's first successful capital conviction in more than a decade. But Freeman has unsuccessfully pursued capital charges in other cases, including against triple murderer Jonathan Sanders and rapist and murderer Kendith Gregory. Both were eventually sentenced to life in prison. But for Chetson, it goes further than the death penalty. He believes the county's legal department needs to diversify from within, pointing to a high turnover under Freeman's tenure and her failure to hire more black lawyers. Quote, "This is a county that's 25% African American, and to not have people in the DA's office reflect the diversity is really appalling." Freeman says a small pool of potential candidates and low starting salaries have made retaining diverse hires difficult. Often, candidates are poached to higher paying jobs within a few years. She says she's hired 16 black candidates since taking office in 2015, and there are currently 6 on staff. Here, Freeman agrees with Chetson. It's a problem, but one she's committed to improving, and says, "We know we have work to do in evaluating the criminal justice system and improving the way it offers services and protects our community." Next, an article by Lisa Sorg, first published in the NC Policy Watch, Fair Games. The surveyors' flags were the first warning. The whine of chainsaws was the second. On a sunny morning in mid-May, residents of the Westover Mount Vernon neighborhood awoke to hear the thud of trees toppling on adjacent land, which until that moment had been a dense forest veined by streams and wetlands for decades. The purpose of the mass timbering was not houses or offices or shops, but a 19-acre parking lot owned and operated by the State Fair, a division of the NC Department of Agriculture. When finished, the lot at 5900 Chapel Hill Road will accommodate more than 2,400 vehicles. A Policy Watch investigation found that, desperate for parking for the 2021 event, which runs in October this year from October 14th to 24th, the State Fair fast-tracked the parking lot project, bulldozing the equivalent of nearly 15 football fields worth of pines and hardwoods in a sensitive part of the Neuse River watershed. What the fair did was legal, if disturbing. Because of a change in state law that favors government agencies, the Department of Agriculture could exempt its own projects, paid for by tax dollars, from stricter environmental rules. Even if 19 acres of pristine forest next to a 100-year-old neighborhood were at stake. The clear-cutting also was allowable under Raleigh ordinances. Julia Milstead, a City of Raleigh spokeswoman, told Policy Watch that projects on state or municipal property aren't subject to Raleigh's tree conservation requirements unless a building is constructed on site. Adding, since no buildings are planned for the parking lot, permission to clear the land is under the state's jurisdiction for state-owned land. Nor was there required comprehensive environmental review of the parking project or its cumulative impacts. And without that review, there was only one opportunity, poorly publicized, for public comment. Jillian Coates, who lives on Gary Street and can see the clear-cutting from her home, she says the state fair is a great event with a long history, but the neighborhood has been here as long as the fair and has a concurrent history. Does the fair not have to follow a protocol? The parking lot was part of a $30 million land sale between Bandwidth, a publicly traded tech company, which bought state property at Edwards Mill and Reedy Creek Roads for its headquarters. The state fair had used that property for parking, so in return for eliminating those thousands of spaces, Bandwidth, via its developer, Athens Development Partners, agreed to improve parking capacity and function for the fair, according to the purchase agreement. Athens Development Partners is a collaboration between East-West Partners and Capital Broadcasting. They are paying for the parking lot. Now, Westover, Mount Vernon, is bordered on three sides by the state fair with only a thin row of trees to buffer the neighborhood. Neighborhood resident Tara Burgess told Policy Watch, "They're coming right at us. This is a government agency abusing its power." As trees fall, neighbors have questions. It was early June, and the Carolina Hurricanes were trying to advance in the NHL playoff. Dozens of fans clad in black and red Canes jerseys has ditched their cars on neighborhood streets and were parading on foot through Westover Mount Vernon towards PNC Arena. "This is nothing," said residents. "You should see it during the fair. People staggering through private yards, urinating, vomiting, yelling, littering. Because of the traffic on NC 54, it can take an hour to leave the neighborhood and twice as long to get back in." Westover Mount Vernon is a close-knit area of modest homes, most of them built from the 20s to the 1960s. The winding, narrow streets, gravel drives, and copses of old trees imbue the neighborhood with a rural feel. On this evening, neighbors gathered in a yard, socially distanced and wearing masks, and shared tales of woe. Clear cutting for the new lot had been going on for more than 2 weeks, within 50 feet of people's property lines. Noise from chainsaws and bulldozers started at 7 o'clock in the morning. Rain had washed silt and mud from the property into backyard streams, which neighbors had captured on video. Those living closest to the future parking lot no longer enjoyed the buffer of green trees. Now they could see orange, snow fence, and daylight. Many neighbors felt stonewalled by state fair officials who had provided vague answers to their questions. On May 10, Coates emailed state fair manager Kent Yelverton, asking him what was planned for the property. On May 13, he responded, acknowledging that the surveyor's flags she had noticed were related to a, quote, potential location for auxiliary parking for the fair, as well as some of our year-round events. "At this time, we do not have final site plans," Yelverton wrote, "but did plan on sharing them with our neighbors in the Westover community prior to the start of the project. That is still our intention." Coates fired back an email. "I do believe you have a plan set for this project because it is currently in its third permitting review by the City of Raleigh. Add to that the staking on site, it actually appears that you are getting ready to start the project." Because the development is occurring on state-owned land, the City of Raleigh has limited authority over the project, primarily permitting the construction of stormwater systems. It is true that certain aspects of the parking lot project had not been finalized in mid-May. The State Fair was still waiting for approval of two water quality permits. Andrea Ashby, spokeswoman for the Department of Agriculture, told Policy Watch via email that at that time there was still some uncertainty about whether the project would proceed, saying, "We contacted the neighbors when we knew the construction would be starting." However, emails obtained under the Public Records Act show that aside from the timbering, construction of the lot was more imminent than the state fair led neighbors to believe. It was scheduled to begin just 3 weeks from when residents began inquiring. As Westover Mount Vernon residents continued to pepper the Agriculture Department with questions, on May 19th, Yelverton mailed notices to neighbors about the construction of the potential lot, scheduled to begin as early as June 1. Trees had already been felled. While Yelverton was trying to placate Westover neighbors behind the scenes, he and several agriculture colleagues were working to expedite the project. The fair had to get state and federal permission to cross, fill, or otherwise disturb small portions of waterways on the property. Three wetlands, totaling more than an acre, as well as five streams, accounting for over a linear mile. Two of those streams flow into Richland Creek, a tributary of Crabtree Creek, which flows into the Neuse River. Permitting, though, can take time, and time the state fair did not have. In mid-April, shortly after the water quality permit application was filed with the NC Department of Environmental Quality, Yelverton started pressuring high-ranking officials to expedite the decision so the lot could be built by opening day of the state fair. In a letter to DEQ Chief Deputy Secretary John Nicholson and Legislative Liaison Joy Hicks, Yelverton anticipated that the 21 fair could be one of the largest ever, considering that the 2020 event was canceled because of COVID. He wrote, "Of course, with large crowds, parking is critical. Bandwidth has committed to having the new lot ready for the fair, which opens on October 14th. This is an aggressive schedule and is subject to weather and other impacts. I ask that the DEQ give this project any priority you can in order to allow as much time as possible to construct the parking lot prior to the opening in October." And DEQ approved the permit on June 3rd. There's no public documented evidence that DEQ gave preferential treatment to the fair. A 60-day turnaround for a permit of this type is not unusual. Email discussions within the Department of Agriculture showed that Yelverton was also concerned about complications regarding a second water quality permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. State fair officials wanted a nationwide permit, a type of general permit authorizing activities that have minimal individual and cumulative adverse effects on the environment. Had the Corps required an individual permit, which is subject to public comment, that could have delayed or derailed the project. Yelverton wrote to several Agriculture Department colleagues, "Time is of the essence because construction is scheduled to begin June 1, so finding a means to fit under a nationwide permit is critical. The time required to receive an individual permit, if we can even get one, is not an acceptable solution. A $30 million land sale and adequate parking for the 21 State Fair is on the line for us figuring this out." After the State Fair adjusted some stream crossings, the Corps granted a nationwide permit on July 6. No public comment was required. The lack of public engagement on the parking lot is not surprising. Except for a purchase agreement, the paper trail did not lead directly to the state fair, but instead was obscured by thickets of bureaucracy. First, the title under which city, state, and federal permit applications were filed, Project Athens, Area 4, omits any mention of the state fair. Project Athens refers to the Bandwidth headquarters, a mile north of the parking lot, presumably named after the development company. Bandwidth Project was also used in one document to describe the parking lot project, also known as event parking. Only by reading the fine print, sometimes pages deep into the document, could someone know that the state fair was behind the plan. when the NC Department of Environmental Quality posted the State Fair's application for a water quality permit, it did so under, quote, Project Athens. There was no mention of the State Fair in the public notice. Spokeswomen for both DEQ and agriculture said their respective agencies don't title the permits. They come from the applicant, in this case, Bandwidth and Athens Development. There's nothing in the statute, though, that prevents agencies from adding clarity to permit names. Yet the state's water quality permit was the only formal opportunity for the public to comment. There were none submitted, according to DEQ, nor did the Agriculture Department know that there was a public comment period, said Ashby. State law also shielded the state fair from scrutiny. Since in 1971, the State Environmental Policy Act, or SEPA, has required state agencies to consider and report on the environmental impacts of actions involving the expenditure of public funds or use of public land. SEPA also requires an environmental assessment and a public comment period, like its federal counterpart, the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. Under the 1971 version of SEPA, all aspects of the State Fair parking lot environmental impact, not just waterways, would have required a full assessment and public comment. But in 2015, the Republican-led General Assembly passed a bill titled SEPA Reformed. Signed by then-Governor Pat McCrory, it significantly changed North Carolina law to exempt state agencies from some requirements of SEPA. Now, all but the largest state projects are exempt from SEPA. Even so, the State Fair parking lot is significant enough to have been subject to even a diluted SEPA. The project is disturbing more than 10 acres of public lands, quote, resulting in substantial permanent changes in the natural cover or topography of those lands or waters, unquote. And it could have a, quote, potential detrimental environmental effect upon natural resources, public health and safety, natural beauty, or historical or cultural elements of the state's common inheritance. Nonetheless, the State Fair plowed through another legal loophole. The 2015 changes to state law also excluded any project, private or public, from SEPA if it requires a water quality permit. Since the State Fair parking lot required both state and federal water quality permits, it was further exempted from SEPA. Westover, Mount Vernon residents were scheduled to meet with State Fair and Agriculture Department officials on the evening of June 3rd. Neighbors hoped they would finally get concrete answers about the project. The neighbors invited several media outlets, including Policy Watch, ABC 11, to cover the meeting. After ABC 11 called agricultural officials about the upcoming event, they canceled it with just 2 hours' notice. The department claimed the cancellation was due to an unexpected scheduling conflict. Ashby, the spokeswoman for the Agricultural Department, told Policy Watch that state officials did not reschedule the meeting because the neighbors had hired a lawyer who had referred to the neighbors as her clients, which referenced potential legal action. Rebecca Evans, who until recently lived on Gary Street and since moved to Colorado, "The only way we could get a meeting was to have an attorney from the neighborhood ask for one. And then the department canceled the meeting because we were bringing an attorney." The Westover Mount Vernon neighborhood has always been part of the State Fair's 2009 master plan, says the Department of Agriculture. However, the master plan map doesn't show a parking lot on the Chapel Hill Road tract. It's merely labeled Western Property. The master plan is how a fair campground wound up abutting the northwestern part of the neighborhood. In what neighbors say is a pattern, they said fair officials did not fully address their concerns. Photos of the neighborhood before and after the campground was built in 2010 show yet another instance of clear cutting at the dead end of Gary Street. Evans says it was scorched earth to the edge. They cut right up to the property line. Because of the construction, Gary Street no longer has a turnaround. Campers routinely take the wrong route, end up at the dead end, but can't turn around. These wayward vehicles now have to back down a circuitous street that has neither curbs nor gutters. The state fair did modify parts of the campground plan to lessen the impact on the neighborhood. With the parking lot, fair officials have increased the size of a buffer between the cleared area and neighborhood. They also plan to erect a fence. Evans said, but they do all the damage to the neighborhood first. The state fair's opening day is less than a month away. This week, trucks were hauling in gravel and construction workers were trying to meet the deadline. Evans said, people in the legislature should take notice that the Agriculture Department is running roughshod over their constituents. And you don't think of the Agriculture Department as not on your side. Another story, which is now I'm reading from the online edition. It was published today, which is actually Thursday, the 23rd. New fee hike spurs UNC Chapel Hill students to seek more and better health and public safety services. And it was originally NC Policy Watch by Joe Killian. Student leaders at UNC Chapel Hill are asking that money from a recently increased security fee go towards student priorities, including additional campus mental health services and gender violence service coordinators, as well as an improvement in safe nighttime campus transit. Early this year, the UNC Board of Governors announced it would hold in-state tuition flat again this year at system schools, but that student fees would be going up. Perhaps most controversially, the board approved a doubling of campus security fees paid by students from $30 to $60, except on those campuses at which that would violate a standing 3% cap on fee increases. Student leaders across the system opposed the increase, particularly as a large portion of the money was slated to go toward hiring and increasing the salaries of campus police officers. Students at various campuses have clashed with police in the last few years. They say they have been frustrated in their attempts to get police to meaningfully address distrust between students and police, particularly about racial and political issues. Last month, the elected leaders of UNC Chapel Hill's undergraduate and graduate students helped write an extensive proposal for directing the extra $725,000 the increased fee will generate. Neil Swamy, president of the Campus Graduate and Professional Student Federation, says, when student fees are being used, students should always be part of the process of deciding how they will be used. And the question always needs to be, are student fees being used in a way that empowers the campus community? Lamar Richards, UNC Chapel Hill student body president, said he and other student leaders have consistently opposed student fee increases, but have been unable to stop them, saying, I'm not a big fan of increasing fees. We want to maintain our affordability, especially at Carolina. If we had to have an increase, we need to figure out what the student needs really are and how to address those. Swamy said, having the undergraduate and graduate professional students present a detailed proposal at United Front is important, because they will work with school administrators and university interests who will ultimately decide. Student leaders agree that improved mental health service is one of the school's most urgent needs. Even before the COVID pandemic, studies showed the existing system were inadequate. According to university data between 2012 and 13 and 2016 and 17 academic years, the number of annual triage visits at the school's Counseling and Psychological Services, CAPS, jumped by 104%. The number of urgent crisis visits increased 101%. Most students spent the last semester learning remotely, where many had limited or no access to campus health services. But during the 2019-20 academic year, university data show 65% of undergraduate, graduate, and professional students at Chapel Hill used CAPS or campus health at least once. CAPS recorded 17,000 visits throughout that year. A UNC system report released this year found 8 of every 10 students reported the pandemic has negatively affected their mental health. 1 in 10 students seriously considered taking their life, during the pandemic, according to the report. Mental health services on campus are woefully understaffed in the face of these increases, students wrote in their proposal. As of April 2021, the permanent staff-to-student ratio at CAPS was 1 for every 2,250 students, falling significantly short of the 1 to 1,000 ratio recommended by the International Association of Counseling Services, they wrote. Quote, in addition, though campus health also provides mental health assessments and referrals, the reach of these services is limited because they're often administered by graduate student interns who only work 2 or 3 days a week and exclusively during the fall and spring semesters. The wave of racial violence in the nation has exposed further inadequacies in the system, wrote the student leaders. Quote, following the murder of Asian American women in Atlanta on March 16th, a coalition of Asian American and Pacific Islander, AAPI, identifying students and allies, petitioned to expand AAPI-specific resources offered through CAPS. The CAPS office doesn't have any Asian American identifying counselors, the students wrote, despite Asian American students making up the largest ethnic minority demographic on campus. The student leaders continued, quote, while CAPS does host a multicultural health program which provides brief therapy, group therapy, and outreach events to BIPOC students at UNC Chapel Hill, the program only has 4 mental health clinicians and has not acquired enough financial investment since its inception to effectively serve UNC Chapel Hill's 9,000-plus BIPOC identifying undergrad, graduate, and professional students. I must parenthetically put in here, this article does not say what that acronym BIPOC stands for. To continue, that's reflected in CAPS data showing minority students use the service far less often, student leaders wrote. According to university data from last year, 65% of CAPS patients identified as white, 12% Asian, 12% Black African American, and 3% Latino. The student proposal recommends hiring 1 psychologist for the multicultural health program at a cost of $93,000 and 2 social workers for on-site mental health care at campus health at a cost of $160,000. These costs include salaries, benefits, continuing ed, and clinical licensure expenditures. Swami said, from the numbers, it's easy to tell this is a major priority for campus safety, if not the biggest priority. Recent surveys also suggest that Chapel Hill isn't doing enough to prevent a rising level of sexual assault or serve student victims. The campus was one of 33 included in the 2019 Association of American Universities Campus Climate Study on Sexual Assault and Misconduct. More than 20% of respondents at the university reported, quote, non-consensual sexual touching or penetration since they came to the school. In most instances, those who experienced such assaults said that they knew the perpetrators and they were other students. Among graduate professional students, an alarming number said they had experienced harassing behavior from a faculty member or instructor. About 22% amongst graduate professional women and 17% among graduate professional men. Following that survey, the school convened a gender-based violence advisory group in June of 2020. The fall report from that group offers a range of suggested steps to address the problem, but students say that effort is going to take funding that isn't yet in place. And they wrote in their proposal, UNC Chapel Hill staffing capacity for gender-based violence prevention lags far behind that of self-defined peer institutions like UC Berkeley, University of Maryland, College Park, University of Virginia, and University of Michigan and Ann Arbor. Of the 16 peer universities reviewed in the 2020 report, 12 have formal offices or centers dedicated to gender-based violence, and 13 have a lower gender-based violence prevention and advocacy staff to student ratio than UNC. Right now, the Chapel Hill campus has just one full-time violence prevention coordinator, one part-time prevention program assistant, and two full-time gender violence service coordinators. The student proposal for use of increased fees suggests $60,000 as an initial budget for the school's recently hired senior prevention strategy officer. That's $2 per student at the school, according to the latest enrollment. The proposal also suggests hiring two more gender violence service coordinators at a cost of $140,000 and the creation of a university-wide Sexual Assault Awareness Month calendar at the cost of $5,000. The student proposal also calls for increased funding for an overhaul of campus Safe Walk System, which is a student-led initiative that provides free escorts to students who have to walk home after dark, either on or off campus. The system is one way of addressing poor after-dark transportation options for students, but according to data provided by student leaders, it isn't meeting demand. The proposal said, in fall 2019, while operating merely 5 nights a week with a single pair of student employees, SafeWalk provided an impressive 7.9 walks per night and was on track to serve over 1,300 students for the academic year. Nevertheless, these data fail to indicate the actual demand for student-led alternatives to those students currently offered by UNC Chapel Hill. In October 2019, for instance, SafeWalks recorded nearly 25 instances over a period of 5 nights in which a student was denied a transportation service because no employees were available to escort them. Students are proposing a new program which would absorb the current SafeWalk program and offer a student-led alternative to the on-demand Safe Ride program, which provides increased transportation options during late-night hours of Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays when school is in session. The proposal calls for $134,600 to hire two teams of walkers, dispatchers, directors, and drivers. It also calls for $43,000 for vehicles and vehicle maintenance. An additional $7,000 would be needed for programming, $2,700 for hardware and uniforms, as well as $2,000 for marketing. So far, talks with administrators over how the new student fee money will be spent have gone well, Swami said. School leadership hasn't committed to anything yet, but they've made it clear that they embrace the goals expressed in the student proposal. Swami said, I think what we've taken away is that our goals are in alignment. As students, we're happy to see any existing source of funding applied or shifted around to fund these things. He continued, if they're successful in getting their goals funded, student leaders hope their proposal will serve as an example to other campuses. Quote, one of the things we've done well here is to work together as undergrad and grad professional students toward goals we all share. I think if you can do that on any campus, you have a greater opportunity for your voice to be heard. Now, as I'm under 5 minutes, I will shift over to a Sarah Edwards column about 2021 fall page picks. And this is essentially ones that she has recommending new books by North Carolina writers about various subjects. And there are about nine books listed here. I'll just mention that we will re-examine for this issue, for this show, Indie Week, how we can obtain, how people can obtain either books in print, books on tape, or programs for computer-read literature for those people who aren't comfortable with print media. But the books seem very important, or at least useful, and I'll go down what I can left of time remaining. The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois, technically the book came out over the summer, and technically Honoré Jeffers isn't based in the Triangle, but she did grow up in Durham. And her debut novel is too southern, stunning, and sweeping not to include. Longlisted last week for a National Book Award in Fiction. It's an ambitious trek through 200 years of American history as told by a line of southern black women. The length is daunting. It's 800 pages. But Jeffers is a poet. She was also a National Book Award nominee for poetry, and she knows how to turn a phrase or two, compelling readers to keep turning pages. Next, Ed Southern's book, Fight Songs. The strands that Ed Southern sets out to explore in Fight Songs are many. The dichotomies between football and basketball culture, for example, or North Carolina's tumultuous identity as a progressive state in the larger South. Or to put a finer point on it, as Southern, yes, that's his real name, does, why do Southerners care so much about college sports anyway? Big question, but Southern, an alumnus of Wake Forest University and executive director of the NC Writers Network, is well poised to try and answer them. Monica Burns' book, a science fiction book, The Actual Star. Her ambitious second novel spans 2 millennia and 6 continents, with characters set in an ancient Mayan dynasty, to the 31st century and beyond. Praised by the famous author Neil Gaiman as a, quote, major player in science fiction, Byrne gives language to existential undercurrents about climate change, resilience, and compassion. Bonus, you can buy signed copies from Letters Bookshop, The Regulator, or Golden Fig Books. And Tazewell's A Good Spy Leaves No Trace. What does an oil industry consultant have to do with an environmental advocate? A parent-daughter relation, for one. Carborough writer Anne Tazewell's fascinating memoir untangles family history and the story of her mysterious, bespectacled father, a decorated World War II intelligence officer and CIA agent based in the Middle East, the kind of real-life character Tom Clancy could only dream of, whose line of work left plenty of room for reckoning. Well, it's time for me to step my long clamber down from our tower. I only have enough time remaining to say that this issue is available on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So until next week, from Indie Week, Journal John Feddersen says so long.